Blue Dot, Episode 7, Engineers Who Get It Done.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem, along with co-host Matt Schiltz. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Dave.
Today we're talking about the E in STEM.
Engineering.
Engineering. It comes from a Latin word that means to contrive and to make things.
So not like the engineering that I do.
Well, you make things, and sometimes you do a lot of contriving to make sure we sound good.
Good point.
So, yeah, we're going to be talking to two guys who are NASA's, like, mainstay engineers, guys that help get things out into space and out to other planets. They have amazing jobs and amazing responsibilities. They are the guys that if something goes terribly wrong, it's their butt that's on the line. And that's a lot of pressure there. Our first guest is Riley Duren. He's a chief systems engineer for the Earth Science Program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And we're going to talk to him about what it takes to get satellites to get up in orbit to actually observe the Earth. So, Riley, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to talk to you a little bit about what goes into preparing a spacecraft for launch.
Right. Well, that's a big question. It's important to know that most NASA science missions are really one-of-a-kind, first-of-a-kind things. So, you know, preparing for launch often takes 10 years or more from when scientists and engineers first come up with the mission concept until it's built and launched. So in my career, I've done everything spanning from early brainstorming where we established the mission architecture and its requirements to designing and building the different components to integrating and testing the complete system through launch mission operations and data analysis. And that's kind of the landscape of what has to be done in general to get these missions ready for launch.
What are some of the missions that you've been involved in? Specifically, what's the most recent mission?
Well, I'm fortunate to have been involved in varying degrees with a lot of NASA missions, but there are two in mind that, that in terms of my personal involvement. One was the Shuttle Radar Topography mission that in 2000 mapped most of the Earth's surface topography to unprecedented resolution. That was on the Space Shuttle Endeavor. But perhaps my favorite is more recent, and that was the Kepler mission that we launched in 2009 that's still operating in orbit behind the Earth around the Sun. And Kepler is conducting a search for Earth-like planets around other stars and has made some really exciting discoveries. I served as the chief engineer for Kepler for development, launch, and commissioning, and that was perhaps the most challenging and rewarding roles I've had so far in my career.
How do you go about, modeling and preparing to simulate for the kinds of forces that are involved in a launch? Because a launch is a pretty violent event, and you've got a lot of delicate instruments. How do you go about preparing for that?
Well, getting into space and operating there put some pretty stringent demands on spacecraft and the instruments they carry. So we have to design them to withstand those environments and then verify that the system we built actually performs as intended. And that verification process usually includes a combination of testing and computer modeling, since we can only partially simulate some conditions on Earth. So, for example, the first environmental challenge a spacecraft faces is from the launch vehicle itself, in the form of acceleration and acoustic energy or sound waves that are produced by the rocket engines. Spacecraft can literally tear apart from the vibration and loads during launch, so we always test them first on special shake tables and in acoustic chambers with huge speakers. And then to simulate the extreme heat and cold conditions of space, we also put spacecraft through their paces in big vacuum chambers. We sometimes call the combinations of those tests shake and bake. And then depending on where the spacecraft is going, it might also have to contend with high levels of radiation. So individual electronic components have to be tested in high-energy particle accelerators. And all this test and verification often takes years to finish, and this is just for the environmental part.
Somehow I just, picture this poor little spacecraft in a room with giant speakers and Metallica being blasted at it.
Yeah, there are some particular bands that we prefer for testing, and they're high on the list.
Okay, that's great. Do you have any particularly memorable mission moments, like maybe something that maybe went wrong and you fixed it at the last moment, anything like that?
We have a lot of, we call them war stories, but my most vivid memories involve space shuttle missions. That's really where I started my career. I worked on a lot of space shuttle missions, and they're vivid because shuttle missions were very fast-paced. These missions typically lasted only a couple of weeks, and they often require quick decisions by those of us both in mission control and the astronauts on board. And I think the one that presented some of the most nail-biters for me was the shuttle radar topography mission. We had deployed a big radar antenna on a 200-foot-long mast from the shuttle payload bay. It's kind of like the outrigger on a Hawaiian canoe, except much bigger and in space. And in order to keep the whole shuttle mast system balanced against gravity, engineers had installed a thruster at the end of the mast with nitrogen gas running through a hose down to a tank in the shuttle's payload bay. And that shuttle thruster, nozzle thruster, froze early in the mission, so we had to scramble to use water from the shuttle to provide an equivalent thruster function. It turns out the shuttles used hydrogen fuel cells to generate electricity, and they produced a lot of water as a byproduct. So fortunately for us, we were able to use that excess water as a kind of backup thruster. And the other big challenge we had on the same mission was when the astronaut sent the command to retract the mast, and everything was going well until it stalled and stopped several inches short of a latch position that was required for landing. And it turned out that the metal cables in the mast that provide tension had gotten very cold during the mission, so they were stiffer than expected. It's like trying to force the lid on an overfull trash can. And if we couldn't get it to latch, we'd have been forced to jettison the entire system. So the engineers ended up turning on some extra heaters, and after waiting for things to warm up a bit, we tried again, and it worked. And today, that mast and antenna are in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, so it was worth the extra effort.
Wow. How many launches have you actually been at? Have you kept track?
You know, I worked on a lot of launches when I was at the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, and I really honestly lost track. That's where we launched Kepler and, of course, all the space shuttle launches, as well as that's where a lot of the landings happen. These days, most of my missions actually launch out of Vandenberg in California, but I've managed to miss all of them. I miss seeing them in person because every time I drive out there, the weather or the rocket doesn't cooperate. And so these days I tend to watch from JPL to avoid jinxing it for everybody else.
And speaking of that, for people who've only seen launches in video or on television somehow, what can you tell us about what the experience is like of watching a rocket actually launch?
You know, the main difference between watching a launch on TV and in person is the sound. The TV just can't capture the feeling that you get of seeing the flash of light as the rocket's launched, particularly at night, followed several seconds later by the shock wave from the sound. The shock waves, the sound waves from launch systems like the shuttle, literally make your clothes vibrate. You can feel it with your face and your hands. And it doesn't matter, you know, how many launches you've seen, they're never boring. I've gotten to where I enjoy watching other people respond, and the expressions range from dumbstruck to, you know, jumping up and down and cheering. My two favorite launch memories was, the first was the return to flight of the shuttle program following the Challenger disaster. I was at KSC in September 1988 when we launched Discovery, and it was my first week at work. But my all-time favorite was the Kepler launch in 2009. I actually bowed out of sitting in the launch control center at the Cape so I could watch my family from a beach nearby. And it was a night launch, and it was really beautiful as the Delta rocket lit up the sky. And everybody was cheering, but two voices in particular stood out. My, at the time, 9-year-old nephew who was yelling, "You can see it, you can see it." And my grandfather, who just kept repeating over and over again, "Wow, wow, wow." And that was one of my favorite launch memories, and I think that's what people take away from being there in person.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with it, what's the mission Kepler? What's it for?
Well, Kepler is a mission that we launched in orbit around the sun. It trails behind the Earth, and it's designed as a space telescope. It's designed to look for Earth-sized planets around other stars. And it's been doing that for some years now, and it's making some spectacular discoveries about, you know, how common are planets in the galaxy and how many of them are the right size and right orbit to be potentially Earth-like.
As someone with an engineering background who is deeply involved in all of these NASA missions, what's something from a engineering standpoint that you're just constantly thinking about, you and your crews, that maybe someone like me, a layperson, would never think about?
I think the biggest challenge for engineers, at least this is what my focus is understanding the reason why we're there and how to make the thing that we're building meet that objective. And since NASA's primarily focused on science and research, that means we have to understand a little bit about the science that's being attempted. And that's hard for some engineers to get their minds around because we're trained to build machines and systems. And we take a lot of the same courses in college, math and physics and science, but we have a very different focus and we're not trained necessarily to work as scientists. So a big motivation for me as an engineer has always been the application of what we're doing with these amazing systems that we're building and flying into space, and learning to understand what it is the scientists are trying to accomplish and how to translate that into the things that we build as engineers is a big challenge, and it's actually an opportunity. I've come to really enjoy working with the scientists, and here and there I get to do some science myself, and that's the nice thing about these STEM careers. You know, you can start out as an engineer and maybe evolve into a scientist and vice versa. I know some scientists who are excellent engineers and vice versa. So that's something I would pass along to people is keep your options open and get the necessary training, and there's nothing to stop you from doing both.
Riley, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Enjoyed talking to you. That's Riley Duren. He's Chief Systems Engineer for NASA's Earth Science Directorate out of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. You're listening to Blue Dot. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Adam Steltzner, the guy who gave us 7 minutes of terror, and it all turned out great. Now we're going to be talking to NASA engineer Adam Steltzner, who's responsible for getting the Curiosity rover down safely onto Mars. He joins us at a park where he's got his kids are off playing and he's talking to us on a cell phone. So if you hear the sounds of little children's voices in the background, that's why. And if I can, I'd like Matt to cue up a song for you real quick to listen to.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
Can you tell us what that song means to you?
Yeah, that is the song that my good friend Miguel San Martin and I chose to play as the wake-up song. The wake-up song is a tradition in space missions at each day of operations. This was a special day of operations when we chose this to be the wake-up song, because this would be the day that we landed either successfully on the surface of Mars or put a smoking crater on the surface of Mars. And apropos of the risks that were involved in that, Miguel and I chose to use Old Blue Eyes' Nelson Riddle arrangement of All or Nothing at All.
And because it really was a situation where it's either complete success or utter failure.
That's correct. There are not a lot of partial credit opportunities for us with this, and we personally had invested the better part of a decade of our lives, but for me, more importantly, hundreds of women and men with whom I labor and who I love and work with had also invested the better part of a decade of their lives. So we had millennia of human effort on this and no real options for partial credit. So when it came down to it, it really was going to be all or nothing at all.
And for our listeners who may not remember, take us through the 7 minutes of terror and the audaciousness of the sky crane maneuver to get Curiosity rover down to the surface, because it was too big to just bounce it with airbags.
Right. You know, if you're going to the surface of Mars, we call it entry, descent, and landing. That's three words, but you really got to do four things. You hit the atmosphere going between 10 and 15,000 miles an hour, depending on the expedition. For us, for Curiosity, we are a little bit above 13,000 miles an hour when we hit the atmosphere. That's going fast enough that the energy of motion, the kinetic energy, can melt or vaporize the entire spacecraft. That's generally considered poor form. So we wrap the spacecraft in a shell called an aeroshell, and we coat it with a material that will smolder and won't burn, and that sheds the energy to the atmosphere, and we sort of burn a hole in the sky on Mars, slowing ourselves down. That slows us down to about 1,000 miles an hour or so, and still not slow enough to land on the surface of Mars, so we open up a parachute. In our case, for Curiosity, the world's largest supersonic parachute opened at just shy of twice the speed of sound on the surface in the atmosphere of Mars. That gave us a huge deceleration and slows us down to a couple hundred miles an hour. Still not slow enough to land on the surface of Mars. So we have to let go of the parachute, which now has done everything it could to slow us down, and we go to rockets. Now, every expedition to the surface of Mars has used these techniques, every successful one. And then depending on how good the rockets are, whether they're throttled, how good your sensors are, whether you can see the surface and understand your position with respect to it and your speed, then you touch down at some final speed. You need some final system. We call it the touchdown system for the Sojourner rover for the Mars Pathfinder mission and Spirit and Opportunity. The touchdown system was airbags, and we bounced to absorb the final impact of landing. But for Curiosity, at 900 kilograms, the size of a car, there are no fibers known to man strong enough for us to use airbags. So we had to invent something new, and a whole bunch of us got together over the span of a couple days in 2003 and used some old ideas, some new thinking, and came up with something that we called the sky crane. And for that, about 60 to 70 feet above the surface of Mars, we lowered the rover below the jet backpack that had successfully got it down to that altitude, and gently deposited the rover on its wheels directly on the ground at about the speed of 1.5 miles an hour or so, a brisk walking speed. And then descent stage, the jet backpack that had lowered it down, cut itself free and flew off to a safe distance, leaving the rover on the surface of Mars ready to begin its mission.
Wow. You're listening to Blue Dot, and we're talking to NASA engineer Adam Stelzner. Adam, you have a book out. It's called The Right Kind of Crazy. What's the genesis of the title?
Well, so this the sky crane maneuver was a little bit of a wacky looking thing. Every time we spoke of it, people would tell us that it looked crazy, and we eventually were hauled up to NASA headquarters to tell NASA's top brass, Mike Griffin, the NASA administrator, why it wasn't crazy. In fact, when we had a meeting with him, it was a big all hands meeting, and he started the meeting by addressing the crowd and saying, "When I heard what these guys were doing, I said to myself, it's crazy. And so I've hauled them here to tell me why they think it's a good idea." And I was giving the briefing, and after the long 90 minutes or so, it felt like an eternity to me, he stopped, and when we concluded, he faced the crowd again, thank God, and said, "You know, I'm not totally certain that he was certain it was a great idea yet, but he said, you know, I still think it's crazy, but, you know, it might be crazy enough to work. It might be the right kind of crazy."
And it certainly
did. That's where the title of the book comes from.
Wow. And what's your purpose for writing the book?
Well, I had a few. The most important was to back away from all this frenetic activity that I engaged in for a better part of a decade and take stock to what I'd learned about engineering, what I'd learned about exploration and humanity, and what I'd learned about working in teams, working with other people, what had worked, what hadn't. The opportunity to write the book really gave me a chance to take stock, to be introspective and retrospective, and really pull out some lessons from a decade of hard work.
If you were to share, like, one simple, most important lesson of leadership, what might that be?
All the great efforts of humanity are done in groups. It may be a strike of genius, a great idea that starts it, but the realization of any good idea takes people working together. And so the quality of the working relationship between the people is a direct influence on the quality of the product that comes out. So in the end, it's all about the people. That is something that I recognized, I'd heard from managers, and I learned it from myself in the process of our efforts. And then from there, once you recognize that it's all about people, then it's all about understanding the people that you're working with and getting them in a position to do the best that they can working together.
Early on in the book, you talk about your personal journey and your childhood, you would not have, if you were, you know, to watch your young self, you would not have seen the trajectory that you wound up on. And you made an interesting comment about, you know, your discovery, looking over your shoulder, of looking up in the sky and seeing Orion, and that got you interested, and that led to going back to school. Could you tell us real briefly about that?
Sure. When I was 21 and playing in clubs around the San Francisco Bay Area, playing rock and roll, I was listless, sort of wannabe rock star, disconnected, bored, frustrated, disengaged from my world. I noticed driving home one night that the stars were in a different spot in the night sky than they had been when I went out to load into the show. I had been a very poor student. I'd missed the whole Earth spinning on its axis thing. So I thought the stars were moving. The constellation that I keyed into was Orion. I didn't know it was Orion at the time. I didn't know my constellations. But Orion is big and bright and boxy, and it's something you can easily track. So I became curious, and I was kind of maybe at a spot in my life after childhood that I had some struggles, raised by an alcoholic father who had a hard time working. I was in a place at my life at this age where I was ready to make something different happen. I was ready to risk something to see what I could make happen. So I went down to the local community college, College of Marin, and I signed up for an astronomy course to teach me why the stars were moving. But it had associated with it a physics course, physics without math, physics for poets. And I took that course. And that sort of opened up the universe to me. Everything changed. Great instructor. He helped connect me with his glee that he had with discovering the universe and the laws that govern it. And that process made me so excited that I wanted to learn about the universe. I wanted to understand it, and I wanted to work hard to see what I could do with that.
It seems to me, as an educator myself that works with teenagers, that there are a lot of youngsters out there that are in a similar place as to where you were then. Is there any advice that you could give maybe to your young self or them, that what you know now that you would like to impart to them?
Yes, absolutely. The first I'd give to the adults around them, which is that certainly when I was that age, I couldn't imagine having a clear-headed notion of what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And in the intervening decades, brain research has demonstrated that actually the human brain shouldn't be expected to really understand what it should do for the rest of its life at the age of adolescence or even into the early 20s, because we don't have a fully baked brain yet. The advice I would give to youngsters, adolescents, is look for what interests you. Look for your passion. Connect with your passion, and then follow it. Really follow it. Allow yourself to follow it, and don't be afraid to work hard. Don't be afraid to stumble. Don't look for a monolithic success as the proof that you're doing the right thing. Just do it. Find what you're passionate about and follow it. And you'll be happy. You might not be rich, you might not be successful, but you'll be happy if you really are following your passion.
I want to thank you for spending the time with us today. I'm thoroughly enjoying the book, The Right Kind of Crazy, by Adam Stelzner. He's an engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Adam, thanks a lot. I really appreciated getting to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Dave.
You've been listening to our program on engineering, the E in STEM. And, you know, for young people out there, engineering careers are huge right now. They're a great gateway to jobs that are exciting and interesting and very rewarding. And you just listen to two of the top engineers in the world talk about that.
And those are the kinds of people who can put something on the face of Mars or put something into different kinds of orbits around Earth and beyond.
Yes, and it's an amazing job. Somebody's got to do it. And, you know, if something goes terribly wrong, you know, they're the people whose reputations are on the line. So it's a lot of pressure. And Dexel, a very special kind of person who's got a lot of confidence and also the confidence to know that maybe something's wrong and you've got to fix it.
And luckily for us, those people aren't you or me, Dave.
I'm certainly glad about that. You've been listening to Blue Dot, a production of North State Public Radio. You can check us out at mynspr.org. Or follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom. And I am Dave Shlom, reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.